This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I'm here in our Lexington, Kentucky studios with my special guest this evening. My co-host Mike Penna will be back with us next week. I would like to welcome everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM 206. And not to forget all of you tuning into our website as well at horseracingradio.net, where you can listen to this show as well as all of your other favorite shows from the Horse Racing Radio Network. My guest tonight is a new face to Kentucky, but he's quickly caught our attention. All the way from England, he's been frequently lighting up the tote board with 63 wins so far in the United States, with many, many more to come. Jockey Jack Gilligan joining me tonight on Jock Talk. Jack, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on, Christina.
Thank you. This is a pleasant surprise. You're here in studio, and you have just, since you first arrived here in the United States, I believe it was last August, you have really caught the attention of a lot of people. You've really let those long shots light up the tote board there.
Well, I've been lucky, you know. I've had a lot of people support me since coming over here, you know. It's a big change, obviously, coming from European-style racing to American racing. So it took a while to get adjusted, but people have been really good and, you know, helped me out loads and loads.
Sure, and we'll talk about that later on during the show. We have an hour here to fill. And, Jack, let's just go back to the beginning, as we usually do here on the show. I know relatively very little about you. We were talking before the show. You know, during my research using Google, you're a relatively mysterious man here. So let's just fill everyone in on your life and where you grew up and how you got to where you are now. So where are you from, Jack?
I'm from Newmarket in England, which is kind of like the Lexington of England. That's where big training center, may have a couple of racetracks there. That's where all the big trainers are based and jockeys. My dad was a trainer for about 20 years. So I've just been born and raised in horse racing my whole life, and I've just wanted to be a jockey my whole life. I can't remember a time when I haven't wanted to be one.
So from the very beginning, you knew what you wanted to do?
yeah.
Really?
I was kind of bred for it.
I suppose so. Your dad's a trainer. Did you have any other jockeys maybe in your family history?
No, actually, both my mother and my father were both first generation into the sport. They both met doing a college degree in equine science, and their dad's always wanted to train. I think the way he got into it was his uncle was a handicapper, and that's how he just got into horse racing that way. And he rode a couple of races over jumps back home, and he got a bit too heavy for that, so then he turned to the training side of things.
So he was a steeplechase jockey?
Yeah, but only briefly.
I think they're quite crazy, honestly, but who am I to talk? But so probably your earliest memories were from the barn.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I was always there. We were based right at the bottom of Warren Hill, and our house was basically right next door to the barn. So I was there 24/7 most of the time, you know, especially as a little kid. I got loads of pictures and memories of just being around the horses all the time.
Were you mucking out stalls as a very little child?
Yeah, dad used my employed me straight away as soon as I was able to fulfill the work and everything. He really helped me out a lot and really taught me a lot. My father and my mother were very good horsemen, and a lot to them. They got me riding straight away. At the age of 5, I had my first pony. I had him for about 2 years. When I was about seven, I actually quit riding for a couple of years. I got quite nervous riding. So from like the age of 7 till 9, I didn't do any riding at all. But I still wanted to be a jockey. I don't know, I was just so nervous riding horses. And at the age of 9, I started riding again on the ponies, and 10, 11, and 12. And at the age of 13, Dad decided that I was able to start exercise riding some of the quiet race horses. So I've been riding the racehorse now for like nearly 7 years. So that's really helped me in my riding. You know, Dad got me going straight as way as, like, you know, as soon as I could do it. And then I did pony racing, which is, you guys don't have it over here, but it's basically full thoroughbred racing, because they're full thoroughbred breds, but they're just 14'2" and below in height, so you class them as ponies. So I did that. I had about 50 mounts there back home, and I rode a few winners and stuff. But that's a good starting board. A lot of jockeys back home in England, they start off doing the pony racing. I was in the British Racing School for 2 years. During when I was at high school, I did a special course where I get a day off each week to go and complete my MVQ in horse care management. And then at the age of 16, I finished school with my credentials, and I started race riding straight off the bat. Had my first ride for my dad. On a horse called Charizard at Salisbury. No, he didn't finish anywhere. But then the next time I rode my second race, I rode the same horse with my dad, and we won at 32-1 at Newbury, so that was really good. And then after that, I started working for a trainer called Sir Mark Prescott in England. I was apprenticed to him for a year. And I think in my whole time in England, then the first year I had about 35 mounts and 4 wins. And 9 places, so that was pretty good. We made the move out to America in August.
Wow. So let's back up. I'm intrigued by the pony races, just because, so you say they are actual thoroughbreds.
Yeah.
They're just very, very small thoroughbreds.
Yeah, they call them ponies, but they're full thoroughbred breds. You know,
sure.
You do get some people, like, who race actual ponies, but most of them...
I guess you would be towards the back of the pack.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so it's pretty competitive. People spend a lot of money, and, you know, yeah,
Do they have a purse structure?
No. No, there's no, but you do get some prizes if you win and stuff, but like very basic stuff.
And you were how old when you were doing this?
I did when I was 14 and 15, but you can do it. Some people start at the age of 10, and you can do it from the age of 10 till 16.
When I was 14, I was not racing ponies. I wish. I would have loved to.
It's really fun.
Did you, it was an actual race. Say it was a typical... I'm not very familiar with European racing, but was it a typical racetrack?
Yeah, they do it. They usually do it like before the actual race, like the actual day's card started, or afterwards. They do it before or after the card. And it'd be like a tape start, and it'd be like a 10 horse field, and they'd do multiple different distances and stuff. And yeah,
weights? Did you have to weigh in?
Yeah, weights. Yeah, you'd have your weights, and you'd have to try and do it and stuff. I mean, they didn't really work. You don't worry about it too much, maybe a couple of pounds here and there, the weight's pretty high, so everyone could do it.
Wow, that just fascinates me. That's fantastic. So then, you go, you're in high school, and you're certain this is exactly what you want to do, especially after your experience riding in the pony races.
Yeah.
So you attend the British Racing School, which has a very, very good reputation for throwing out very good riders. Tell us about that in detail. Tell us what you learned there.
Well, basically the course I did, they include like half the course is riding and half the course is learning about horses. So anything from anatomy to feeding and just general management of horses. So it's like, you know, they prepare you for the riding side of things, but they also prepare you for, you know, if you want to go down the trainer's route as well, which is very good. Including that, I mean, they did jockey coaching, you know, you get a lot of work on the exercises and, you know, jockeys just giving you advice all the time and stuff. They do a lot about the nutrition. Fitness is a big thing as well. They incorporated that into, and then on the side of like the training, it'd be everything from just teaching you, you know, the nutritional of, you know, how you should be feeding your horse, what they need, bandaging, everything really, you know, anatomy of the horse they concentrated on. And a lot of that stuff really helped out, you know, for me now, because it just gives me a broader knowledge of the horse and everything, which may some other people don't have.
I was just going to say, Jack, we've had some people on the show who have had a similar upbringing, I suppose you could say, and that has to be such an advantage to know so much about the horse, to know what actually goes into prepping a horse for a race. You have to have a respect for the people working with that horse, but also just to know the nutrition of a horse, just to know all about the horse that you're riding, that has to be somewhat of an advantage, yes?
Yeah, I feel so. You know, you get a better feel for the horse, and you know, when you're riding a race as well, you'd appreciate more about how much work goes into actually training the horse. You know what goes on behind closed doors, and you know, in a way, I find that makes me try a lot harder for people, because I know how much work they do. You know, seeing my father do it and stuff.
So your dad trained for 20 years, I believe?
Yep.
And did he have a large barn of horses?
Yep. We when he started out, he only had a couple of horses. He started out just by himself. He didn't really have any owners backing him. And the second horse he ever bought, he bought for about 400 pounds, which is about $700. And that horse went on to be his best horse, and it won a couple of graded stakes races, and you know, took him around Europe. He ran a couple of races in France, and he won a couple of big races there, Newmarket, on Guineas Day. So that car brought him on a lot, you know, got him a lot of fame, and you know, got owners for him. And the most we had was about 30 horse barn at the height of his career, and towards the end we had about 10 horse barn. And yes, Dad's always trained there in Newmarket, and he's over here at the moment with me, so that's good. I like having him around.
Well, of course, and I would say that's a good investment on that horse that cost $700. Yeah. That's very, very impressive. Yeah. And I would think that would catch the attention of owners.
Yeah,
of
definitely.
Course.
Yeah, well, that's what helped him out a lot, you know. And yeah, that horse only, I think he earned about 120,000 pounds in purses. So
wow.
Yeah, it was pretty good. So, you know, Dad's always had good, he's been a good horseman. That's what's taught me a lot as well. You know, he's very good at everything, the training side.
Of course. Who would you say, besides your dad, who would you say you looked up to the most during those very early years, maybe your time in the British Racing School? Who was your mentor?
Well, I actually had a mentor called Philip Robinson. I'm not sure if he'd be very famous over here, but he was quite a top jockey back home. And he kind of took me under my wing for a couple of years, especially before I started riding. And when I started riding, he was a very good jockey coach to me. I go in for teaching sessions with him a couple of times a week. And he was really good, and, you know, he just taught me everything. You know, him being a jockey, he was champion jockey a couple of times back home. And he was a very valuable asset and someone I looked up to very much.
Of course, and champion jockey, someone good to learn from, obviously. Now, you did learn, you actually served your apprenticeship under Sir Mark Prescott, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct.
So he is a very, very successful trainer. I believe he has 1,300 wins under his belt. And I looked him up. He actually rode as a young man and unfortunately fractured his back in a riding accident. So coming up under him, he must have taught you a lot as well.
Yeah, he's renowned in back home as being a very hard taskmaster. He's very tough to work for. He does everything very old school. He's the longest serving trainer in England, I think, at the moment. He's been training for over 45 years. And he's does everything old school. We'd have to, I worked about 13 hour days for him. We'd start off at 4:30 in the morning. We'd skip schools. and then we'd ride 3-4 sets, sweep all the yards, do the feeds, and then in the evenings we'd do a 3-hour-long evening stables. We'd have to brush them, grease their feet. Everything had to be done, and every evening he'd come walk around and see all the horses. He'd have to stand them up against the walls, and they'd have to have quarter marks on, and yeah, everything was done very properly, and that helped me out a lot because you know, he made sure it was like being back at it was being like a strict boarding school or something. You know, everything had to be perfect all the time. You know, you had to be very punctual. You had to be dressed well all the time. And that taught me a lot of respect and, you know, just a good way of presenting myself all the time.
What would happen if he saw a horse that maybe was not groomed to his liking? What would he do?
You know about it.
You would know about it?
Yeah, he would make you do extra chores for sure. And he'd just chew your ear out pretty good at the time. And he'd make you do it properly while he's standing there watching you.
Wow.
Yeah, he was pretty tough.
But sounds like... Absolutely.
But it's good, you know, it teaches you a lot, and it helps you in the long run. You know, when you're doing it, you hate it, but, you know, you appreciate it now.
Looking back on it now, you realize how much you actually did learn, I'm sure. Now, how about your actual riding? Did he ever point out things to you that he noticed maybe about your riding style, fix this, fix that?
Definitely. Every day, you know, every day I come into work after I've had, like, having a race the day before, he'd always come and he'd ask for me to come into his office and speak to him about the race and stuff. And we'd go over the race and he'd give you all sorts of tips, you know, where I should have been in that spot or da da da. Just overall, he was a very good person to work for.
Now, you rode for him too, in actual races, of course.
Yeah, I rode a few races for him. I didn't get any wins for him. I had a couple of seconds, but that was all.
That's still good. That's still good. Were you extra nervous maybe going out to the paddock knowing you're riding for Sir Mark Prescott?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely a bit more pressure. He's very well respected in England, so it's kind of almost like a privilege to ride for him. So, you know, you made sure not to screw up or anything.
Of course. Now, I also saw that you won a race at Newbury. And again, I do not know a lot about European races here, but it was in a JRL Group Series for your grandmother's horse, I believe Shahrazad.
Yeah, Shahrazad. Yeah, that was my first ever win. That was the one for my dad and my second ride. So yeah, it was my grandma's horse, which is very good. And they've been owning horses for my dad for quite a while. She was one of their best horses as well.
Really?
Yeah, she won about 5 races for them.
So. How was that crossing the wire in front for your family?
It was pretty well. It was funny actually. I only won by about a nose, and at the time I actually thought I got beaten.
No.
On the gallop out and coming back in. It wasn't until I'd almost got right into the wizard enclosure that my grandma said, "You won." It was the best feeling ever. That was definitely one of the best ones.
So when I won my first race as well, Jack, I didn't know I had won either. It was a photo, but I was not riding for my grandmother, nor was I riding for my father. So you had to be a little bit nervous going back. That had to be a little bit of extra pressure, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I suppose it kind of is, but it isn't as well because it is your family, you know, so you can't understand. I suppose they would be kind of a bit more understanding than if you got beat by, you know, say if it's Sir Prescott and I got beat, maybe I got chewed out a little bit.
Sure. I guess it depends on your family too, how hard they would be on you. But so you rode in England and you began riding in England at the age of 16.
Yeah.
So you're very, very young. And you rode in England for about a year. And again, as we said, riding for Sir Mark Prescott and your family. And so again, I don't know a lot about European racing, but the atmosphere of the jocks room in England compared to now what you know in the United States, how was it riding over there being so young and inexperienced at the time? Would the older riders help you out?
They did. It was kind of tough. I didn't have actually very many rides. It's very different the way things work in England when you're an apprentice. Because it's not done on a time limit, it's just done on the amount of wins you have. people usually apprentice for 3 or 4 years. And when you start out, you're kind of only really expected to have 10 or 20 mounts your first ever year as a jockey.
Wow.
Then your second year, you may go up to 50, 60, and your third year, over 100. And then by fourth, you'd be getting up there, you know, 200 wins and 200 rides and, you know, 50, 60 wins. That's really good. That would win you the apprentice championship back home. So when I started out, obviously, I'd only had 30 rides in that first year. So I wasn't very well known in the jocks room, but I had a few. There's Tom Queeley, used to help me out a lot, and Adam Kirby as well. But most of them, you know, I find in America, the jockeys have been a lot more welcoming for me, actually, even back home. But like I say, it might just be because I ride a lot more here, so they get to see a lot more of me as well.
So you rode in England for a year, and you went, you were part of an exchange program with the British Racing School, which brought you here to the United States. That was, I believe, in 2013?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's the reason why I've always wanted to come back. When me and my friend Benjamin Rablad, we were both doing very well in the British Racing School. We were getting good grades and doing really well on our riding. So they asked us if we'd like to participate in an exchange to North American Racing Academy. And we were like, yeah, sure, definitely. So we came over here for a week and just loved it. We did a lot of riding. I stayed with Remy Belloc and his family, and then I spent a weekend with Chris McCarron, and he took us around, took us to Keeneland, Churchill Downs, and that's what really kind of made me fall in love with American racing. And ever since then, that was the time I said, I want to come back to America, I want to come and ride here. I really loved it, everything about it.
And Jack, I actually attended the North American Racing Academy, so I know exactly who you're talking about. And of course, everyone knows Chris McCarron, and what a great group of people to be associated with on your first trip ever to the United States. And so you fell in love with Kentucky.
Yeah, I just loved it here. You know, he took us to Keeneland and Churchill Downs, which I suppose they're kind of spoiling us, really. You know, and he took us up into the jocks room. Chris McCarron introduced us to all the jockeys, and just everything about it. Just, I don't know, maybe because it was very different, but it's kind of the same thing, you know. It's a horse racing that I loved anyways, but it was something different, and it kind of just spun, you know, just made me really want to try out.
Made you want to get back here is what it made you want to do. And so you started riding in England, and you knew during that year, when you rode in England, you always knew that was your goal, was to make it back here.
Yeah.
And were people aware of that? Were people aware that you would be eventually leaving? Did Sir Mark Prescott know of your intentions?
He knew a way. He didn't know that I wanted to come over permanently, but I always made it clear to him that I'd like to come over, definitely maybe for the winter time or something, just spend a couple of months over here work riding. So he knew about that, but it wasn't till a month or two before I eventually did leave. I said to him, I'm going to go and I'm going to try and stay if I can, and give it a go over in America.
What did he say?
He was really supportive of me. He was kind of sad to see me go. He said, you'd probably do a lot better next year over here and stuff. But he said, if this is what you want to do, you should do it. He said, you're young and, you know, England's always going to be here if you ever want to come back and stuff. And he said, you know, America's great and, you know, you can do exceptionally well over there if you try hard enough. And yeah, I said thank you very much, and off I went.
See you later. See you later. That's what Jack said. Now, what I find very, very interesting is that your parents and the family cat moved to the United States with you.
Yeah, we all did. We all came over. It was, in the end, it was a family decision, really, to come over. Dad had always wanted to come over, as he is originally from America. And Mum as well, you know, she was working back home in England as assistant trainer. And she kind of just been in the same job, and it was kind of a bit dead end. And she wanted to change, wanted to have a change as well, you know. And the cat, I suppose, she was just happy to stay with the family or whatever.
As long as she had a warm bed.
Exactly. As long as Mum was feeding her, she was happy with Larry. So yeah, we all came over, and it was a big, it was a really nice family adventure coming over. We actually flew over to New York first. And we spent a couple of days in New York City, and then we drove up to Boston, where we've got some family up there. And then we did a big long road trip all the way from Boston down to Lexington. So that was really fun.
It's a long road trip. I've made that before.
Yeah.
Very long road trip. So I assume you guys had a place to live already, or was that part of the search? Was it pretty stressful moving everything over here to the United States?
We just kind of just brought some clothes and our basics that we needed. We all the stuff we had back home, we just sort of put into storage. And we came over and we stayed and lived in a hotel here in Lexington for about 2 weeks. And in the meantime, we were searching for apartments and stuff to lease, and we finally found one over in Beaumont. And we've been there ever since. It's a really nice area. We like it there.
Good. You love Lexington. Are you a UK fan? I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah.
Good. I went to the game last night, so I had to ask you that
yeah,
question.
Yeah, I watched it. It was good.
It was good. I'm nervous now for the next game.
I haven't actually been and watched it live, so I will try and do that if I can.
Oh, you have to go to Rupp Arena. Absolutely. Yeah. We'll talk after the show and I'll tell you exactly all about it. But so you moved here, you had just packed your bags, you didn't have a place to go, your family's coming with you.
Yeah.
Or you had to be a little bit nervous. I mean, that's a lot of pressure. Your whole family's with you.
Oh yeah. But but my parents are very supportive of me. They always want to do what's best for me, and they always support my decisions, and they always try and help me out as much as I can. So, you know, that helped out a lot. You know, obviously I knew Chris McCarron and Remy Belloc when I came over, so they helped out a lot. You know, when I came over, I went straight to school and, you know, talked to them, and they helped point me in the right direction, where to start, who I should start galloping for, and, you know, helping me out in that department of things. So, you know, it was a big leap, but it was something that we kind of had to do, and it was kind of nice to do that, you know, just go into the unknown. And, you know, it's the same thing over here as America, so it was kind of easy moved going straight back into horse racing. You know,
horse racing is horse racing, but that was definitely a leap of faith, and it paid off, as we'll continue talking about. We'll be back with Jockey Jack Gilgan after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Get ready for the third annual Jockeys and Jeans charity event to benefit the PDJF, coming to Gulfstream Park on Saturday, February 27th. Last year, Jockeys and Jeans raised more than $200,000 to benefit permanently disabled riders, and you can help make this year's event even bigger. Meet and mingle with an all-star cast of jockeys, including Lafitte Pinkai Jr., Georgie Velasquez, Pat Day, Randy Romero, and many more. Tickets go on sale at the beginning of January, and donations and sponsorship can be purchased starting December 7th. For more information, visit jockeysandjeans.com.
Hey, I'm Chantel Sutherland Cruz, and want to tell you all about BetAmerica.com. It's the coolest place to bet on horse racing on over 200 racetracks from America and around the world. New players receive a 100% bonus on your first deposit, up to $300. That's the best sign-up bonus available today. It's time to play the Bet America way.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Pena, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick,
It's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word JOCKEY to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms, mgive.org/chi.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. First, let's head to Kentucky, where Julian Leperoux had a great week as he won the Grade 3 River City Handicap, the Grade 2 Goldenrod Stakes, and the Grade 2 Kentucky Jockey Club Stakes aboard Aeroforce. Leperoux finished the week with 6 wins, 4 seconds, and 5 third-place finishes. Corey Lannery had a solid week as he came in the money on 66% of his mounts and highlighted his week with a win in the Zia Park Oaks aboard Lavender Chrissy. For the week, Lannery finished with 10 wins, 8 seconds, and 11 third-place finishes. Irad Ortiz also had a strong week in New York and Ohio by winning 3 stakes, including the Grade 2 Demoiselle Stakes aboard Lewis Bay. Ortiz finished the week with 8 wins, 5 seconds, and 3 third-place finishes. Finally, our Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Mike Smith, had a great week at Del Mar and Churchill Downs, highlighted with wins in the Hollywood Turf Cup aboard the Pizza Man, the Clark Handicap aboard FNX, and the Cecil DeMille Stakes aboard Dresden Hermes. Smith finished the week with 3 wins and 1 second place finish. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, is the perfect gift for anyone on your Christmas list who has wondered what it takes to be a professional jockey. The sport's most prominent jockeys and trainers tell their stories and share their insights on all that goes on behind the scenes. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit jockeytalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all of the latest news in the jockey world, visit jockeytalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Christina McManigle here, joined tonight by jockey Jack Gilligan. And Jack, we were discussing before we went to the commercial break about your move, your initial move to the United States, and how that had to be a little bit nerve-wracking, given that your family moved with you as well, and the pressure was kind of on you at the time. And so I'm going to ask you, did they find jobs and you started exercising horses and found an agent, I'm sure? Take us through the process.
So when we first came over, it was kind of more like a holiday for mom and dad, baby, because they've been working basically without any holiday for the last few years back home. So when they came over, they just came and they just sat, you know, took it easy for a couple of months. I started galloping for Jimmy Corrigan over at the training center. And he's the first person to give me a mount over here. And then I started moving around the training center, work riding for more and more people, and then eventually over to Keeneland as well. And I did that for about a month before I started race riding over here.
So your parents enjoyed their vacation while you're out there working, hustling hard at the training center.
Yeah, they deserved it. They needed it.
Well, of course. And you understand that now, especially given that you know the rigors and the hard lifestyle and the early morning hours that come with working in this industry. So you started riding for Jimmy Corrigan, whom I know very well, being at the training center myself back in the day. But I want to ask you, racing is a very small world, and so were there trainers that you had known from England or friends of friends kind of situations? Did you know people here when you first arrived, I should say?
Not in Kentucky, actually. I knew people that we knew back home. They knew people in America, you know, work riders and jockeys, but they were actually mainly in California and New York. So it wasn't really any help to us over here, but I had Chris McCarron and Remy Bellock, and they're the ones who helped point me in the direction of people I should, you know, try and start riding for and stuff. And so Jimmy Corrigan was one of the first, and like I say, he gave me my first mount there at Indiana, which was really nice of him. And it was only, you know, I'd only been in the country about a month, and he'd straight away put me up on one, so that was really good.
How did the horse run?
He just ran midfield. Elmore, it was his name. But I ended up, I won like 2 races on him back in Turfway during the winter a couple months later. So it was good. It worked out in the end.
That's all that matters. So you started riding at Turfway, and this was in the winter, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
and it's very, very cool, the Turfway. I know this very, very well. It's freezing, in fact. And you took off.
Yeah, I was very lucky. The first day of the meet, I rode a double. And then I rode another double at the end of the first weekend. So I rode four winners in the first weekend. And it just got on the roll straight away from there. You know, people gave me an opportunity that first weekend. And, you know, I took it and things just snowballed, you know. Every weekend I rode a couple of, you know, four winners nearly every weekend. I only just had two. I rode a double like every single weekend of December, which is really good. And like I say, people were just really good, giving me plenty of opportunities. You know, I was going and working a lot of horses for people. You know, I decided there was talk of maybe we were going to go back home for Christmas, but I decided against it. I thought, no, it'd be good, you know, keep the ball rolling as much as we can. You know, we did great all the way right through to January.
You mentioned Christmas, and I laughed because I was just talking with our producer before the show how I almost always rode on Thanksgiving, and it was very nice to eat this year. So it's, you know, exactly the brutal schedule sometimes that you have when riding, and you're working horses in the morning and you're tired and you're riding at night, maybe at Turfway. Yeah. But tell me, is working horses in the morning, is that similar to in England? Did you hustle just as hard over there?
No, it's very different. In England, because nothing's really done on the racetrack, they're all at training centres. And at those training centres, they're not really like real training centres, they're really spread out. So like Newmarket, there's about 80 trainers, but they're spread all over the town. So you might have a few stables which are located close to each other, but you can go out and hustle around all the barns in the morning. And that's why jockeys, they get attached to certain stables. So like when I was apprentice to Mark Prescott, and I just worked crowed for him in the mornings, and he was the only person I worked crowed for. That's why it probably takes a lot longer to get going in England, because you're only really connected to one stable, and the only time other people start using you is when you start doing good for that one stable, then they'll start, you know, using you on some of their horses as well, different outfits. So yeah, it was very different. It's something I had to learn pretty quickly over here, you know, meeting people, which, you know, meeting trainers, you know, and just trying to hustle rides, it was something that's very different because you're not taught it and you don't have to do it back home.
I guess you don't have agents back home?
Yeah, you do, but they mainly just stay at home. Maybe they just speak on the phone. They just kind of really organize, you know, the horses you're riding, you know, yes or no, I can ride that horse, I can't ride that horse. They don't really go out and, you know, they don't hustle trainers as much as over here, for sure.
Sure. Sounds like a kind of an easy job.
Yeah.
So your agent, tell me about your first agent when you moved here, and is he still your agent now?
No, when I first came over, I had Mark Johnston. He's a Clips winning apprentice jockey up in Maryland. He rode about 2,500 winners.
Sure.
So he was really good to have as my first agent because, you know, he helped me with the American style of riding and stuff. He was a successful jockey himself. And he had me from when I started out, all the way through the winter and until about May. And then when Churchill came over, I switched over to Jose Santos, who I've got at the moment.
And he is the son of a very famous jockey, yes?
Yep. Yeah, he's Jose Santos Jr. and his dad's Jose Santos, the top jockey. In between September and October, I actually had Doug Bradar. I switched to him because Jose was taking some of his finals. He's at college at the moment.
Oh, wow.
So we took a break then, and I had Doug Braid off. It was 2 months. It was really good. You know, he introduced me to a lot of top trainers and got me work right, you know, working a lot of good horses for people. So that was a great experience to have him.
Of course. And it is very important over here, especially the relationships that agents develop with trainers, because that's very important. As a jockey, you're looking to hire someone who has a lot of those good relationships, not bad. You don't want to be known as a bad agent who takes off horses and things like that. So that's very, very important, as you know, to get a good agent. And you obviously are doing very well at the moment. So you obviously have a good team behind you. But tell me about Mark Johnston, you said, who again, as you mentioned, he was your first agent. He was a successful jockey. He kind of introduced you to the American way of riding.
Yeah.
So tell me what he taught you.
Just, you know, everything, the American style, and, you know, just the American way of riding, you know, being fast out of the gates, getting a good position early on in the race, switching leads as well, which is something that I didn't even know about really when I came over. In Europe, they don't teach you about switching leads, or, you know, they don't even touch on how it's important in any way, which, you know, it was something that a big, you know, learning curve when I came over was those sort of small technical things that make a huge difference.
Switching leads, that is so interesting because that is obviously, to those of you listening might not know, switching leads is the leg the horse first strides out on. So you're on your left lead around the turn, you're on your right lead coming turning for home. It's very important, I feel, as though so the horse has a fresh leg to reach out on.
Yeah, definitely.
So that had to be just completely different style.
It makes sense, you know, completely. It'd be a good, you know, sign. You know, it'd be a little good trick up your sleeve if I ever went back home to England, you know, because no one ever thinks about it, you know. It's funny, I watch some races now and I can see horses that they get beat because they don't switch leads and stuff down the stretch and stuff at home. So it's funny, but, you know, something as big as that, I think it's very important as well here, you know, that horses switch leads and is something that's not even a part of horse racing in England at all.
Go back over there and tell them about that secret you learned. And you say also about breaking out of the gate. And I'm assuming in England, from what I've seen, speed is not so important over there.
No.
So to break out of the gate very quickly is not as important over there. So were you not great breaking out of the gate when you first came over here?
Yeah, I wasn't very good at all. When I was, you know, practicing in the morning and stuff, I'd fall back on my mouse a little bit and... Yeah, something I had to learn pretty quick. But Chris McCarron helped me loads and loads with that. He was really good. He helped train me a lot with breaking out, and I feel I'm pretty good now. But yeah, it's very different in England. You know, the first two furlongs are usually the slowest, and the fastest two are the last, and it's kind of the opposite over here. And you know, races are run over a lot longer distance, so it isn't as important to get out and get in a real good position early because you've got so long to establish a position. That was a big difference as well. Definitely something I had to learn.
How about the way you sit on a horse? I've noticed that European riders oftentimes sit more upright on a horse's back. And when I watch you ride, and just so you know, you are very good breaking horses out of the gate now. But when I watch you ride, you look like an American rider. You're down low on the saddle. Was that hard to learn?
Well, it was actually funny. When I came over for the exchange, Chris McCarron really drilled it into our heads about, you know, how the American style is very good. You know, it's a very balanced position, you know, compared to the English style where your car bouncing up a little bit and, you know, you're just not as neat and in sync with the horse. And at that time, I hadn't really developed the style because I was so young. Yeah, I hadn't started race riding. So it's kind of good that when we came over, Chris McCarron taught us that. So I'd always kind of base my style as much as I could off the American style. You know, trying to be a bit more stiller in the finish, you know, my body not bouncing and stuff. So when I eventually did come over, it was a lot easier for me to adapt to the, the full American style than other people. And Chris McCarron helped me a lot with that when I came over. I did a lot of coaching on equisizers at NARA and stuff. So that really helped a lot.
For sure. The equisizer is a very valuable tool to get that down. Now, how about the weights over here are also lighter than in England?
A lot lighter.
So was that tough for your eyes just got big? For those of you listening on the radio, his eyes got big. Was that tough for you to get down to weight?
Oh, yeah. I was actually really light when I came over, but in England, I never had a weight problem. I never even had to think about the weights in England. They're so much higher. They'd be about, you know, 121, 122 would be like the lowest you'd ever get. And, you know, most of them would go all the way up to nearly 132, 133 pounds. So weight was never an issue with me back home. And when I came over, it wasn't in the beginning. But the older I got, you know, obviously it was around that time I was just 18, you know, just turned 18. I started to mature a bit, so I was getting a little bit heavier anyways. And I'm very tall anyways. I'm about 5'9". So I've always been having to keep an eye on my weight over here, but touch wood, I've been really good. I've always, you know, hit my weights. It's nice now being a journeyman. That extra couple of pounds, I've really appreciated it for sure. This last month or two.
I will never forget the day that I lost my apprenticeship, Jack, and I could actually eat food. And you are probably the only jockey I've ever met who I don't have to reach down to speak to. So I can only imagine how tough it had to be for you. It was extremely tough for me as well. And I mean, I could ride in England now at my size now, yeah. But when I rode here, especially with that apprentice weight, it's extremely tough for those of us who are very, very tall.
Yeah.
And how about... It's a fine line between being light and being strong. So you can't put on too much muscle because that weighs more, obviously, yeah. than fat. What was your workout regimen like? Would you work out? Would you run? What would you do?
I would, I'd go to the gym every day in the morning. After I finish morning workouts on the horse, I'd come in and I'd do about 40 minutes in the gym. I'd usually try and sweat a pound or two on a running machine or something. I do weights and stuff, but I always balanced it. You know, I just did however much I did basically the same exercise routine I did back home in England. And that seemed to work really good for me back home. It kind of was a good balance to just keep maintaining my fitness and without making me too, you know, build up too strong or anything. So I kept that same training regime when I came out. So that helped out a lot. You know, I don't think... I maintain my weight usually just through diet. I didn't go in the sweat box and I never flipped or anything. So that was the main thing. I always find, you know, it's good to have good energy levels. You know, I've never really felt too unfit on the horse. You know, I've never got really too tired. A couple of times when I've rode the card, I've got a bit tired towards the end of the last race or two. I'm like, whew, my legs are feeling a little bit now. But, definitely, I always found that just eating a good varied diet definitely helped my riding. You know, when up in the, you know, having to be about 109, 110, it's a struggle. But you know, as long as I'm getting all the food that I need, then I felt I was always pretty strong. But I'm definitely a lot better now that I'm able to be a pound or a couple of pounds heavier. I've really noticed, you know, watching my races back and stuff, I look a lot stronger, I think.
And people don't understand maybe the difference that just a couple pounds can make. That's the difference between grabbing a drink of Gatorade and between races.
Yeah.
It's a huge help. It's a huge help. You mentioned your diet, and you're very smart because that's the best way, of course, to maintain your energy and to, you don't have to sit in the hot box, but you're strong when you go out there. And what is that diet? What when you wake up in the morning? Take us through what is your meal schedule, I guess you could say.
Well, basically, I don't usually have anything for breakfast. And actually, I usually hardly have anything for lunch either. I might have, when I get to races, I might have a handful of peanuts. But yeah, usually during the day, I don't really eat anything at all. I drink a bit of water or some vitamin water. I usually have that. But usually what I do is then I'll have a normal dinner, you know, I'll have quite a lot for dinner, but it's all very healthy food. I usually have, you know, a piece of lean meat, chicken, or, you know, small piece of steak or something, with some stir fried vegetables and maybe like half baked potato. And it varies, you know, I'll have chicken some nights, I'll have maybe a piece of fish or something. Which I enjoy, and I usually kind of keep that sort of diet during the week, and then on Sunday is kind of my day off. I'm after racing on the Sunday because I got Monday off the next day, so I'll go out for a meal with my parents then, and that's kind of like my day where I can eat all you can on a Sunday evening. But I find like that definitely helps mentally, like I cash during the day. I've gone to a routine where I don't actually feel very hungry during the day. I'm at work for me. You know, some people, they can't, they have to have something every now and again. But I kind of like being able to go home and having a nice proper meal and not having to deprive myself for anything. You know, I have a little bit of chocolate in the evening. And like I say, I can have a good meal and feel satisfied at the end of the day. And then on the Sundays is all Sunday evening. I can eat a lot. I can eat under the table if you let me.
No, but you're right. It is a big, more, I think, than physical, because you do get used to not having food in your stomach. But mentally, it's like what I would say torture.
Definitely.
Because you can't eat anything. I would chew gum all the time because it was just that action of moving your mouth. It's that mental trick. And so Sunday to you has to be, of course, your favorite day of the week, I'm sure.
Always thinking about Sunday. It's terrible. I mean, it's definitely the toughest part of, you know, our sport. I feel the toughest thing I find is just, you know, maintaining the weight. And it is definitely a big mental thing, you know, food. Just, you know, it's always on your mind, you know, being hungry and stuff. So that's the toughest thing I find. But like I say, at the moment, I've gone a real good routine and, you know, I haven't had a real big problem with it. You know, there's some days when I'm a little bit heavy, but I just have to work a bit harder in the gym in the mornings, you know, and it hasn't been a big problem where I'm like, oh, I need to lose 4 pounds and I'm at the races. You know, I've never had to go on the sweat box or anything. So I've been lucky.
I hate the sweat box. That's good. Keep it like that. So you just lost your apprenticeship. So this past Sunday, what did you eat?
I had the same thing. I've just kept the same routine.
No, you just keep it like it is.
I've just kept exactly the same as I was because I'm tall and I'm at that age where, like, I could still shoot up a little bit. So I'm just keeping everything, trying to maintain that weight, keep it down low. And keep it, you know, it's kind of nice this way, like those days when I got real heavy weights, you know, then I can have a little bit of lunch now, you know, which is nice. And that's definitely another thing, you know, like that's been the only thing I've changed up is like when I've got heavy weights, I'll have a little bit of lunch, I'll have a sandwich or something, which is nice to have, which I didn't have for the last year.
Nice change.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We're here with Joggy Jack Gilligan on Jog Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Take us through a typical day of the day in the life of Jack Gilligan when you're riding. Say it's Turfway, Churchill, doesn't really matter, but what your workhorse is in the morning, and then take us from there.
Yeah, so it depends what time I need to get to track at. Usually, you know, first work will be about 6 o'clock, so I'll wake up at about 5:15. So say if I'm breezing at Keeneland, I'll wake up about 5:15, 5:20, get up, get changed, go to the track, get on my first set, ride the breezes I need to ride, and then once I finish there, I'll go around all the barns, try and meet as many trains as I can. And I usually finish up about 9 o'clock. And if I have time, I'll go over to the training center. If I'm finished a little bit earlier at Keene, I'll go to the training center and meet people there. And say at Churchill Downs, if I'm right at Churchill Downs in the first race, I have to be at the track about 11:30, a bit before. So I'll get home, I'll get changed, have a shower, I'll head on off to Churchill. Get to races, I'll do a lot of stretching. They got a jockey exerciser in the room there, so I'll go on that a bit before a race. I go through all my races the night before. I'll go through on Equipace and watch all their previous runs on the replays. So I know what I've, you know, what if they got any quirks or, you know, if they don't, or switch leads and stuff like that. So I know that before I get to races. So before my race, I'll go through a card. I'll mark out where the speed is and if there's any horses that could come off from off the pace. And then I get ready for my races. I get changed and ride them. I try to just take every race as it comes, and before every race I'll go through and just do that same ritual, looking through the form book and seeing where the dangers are and who I should be looking out for.
You're doing everything right, Jack. You're fully prepared going into the race. You're energized with eating right, and you will have a very, very long and successful career in front of you. I can see that for sure. You have, so we were talking during the break, you've ridden at Turfway, Keeneland, Churchill, Ellis, Belterra too, I believe.
Belterra, and I've also ridden in Del Mar. I went out there for a weekend in the summer, which was really fun. I rode there. I rode two horses over there for Michael Ann Ewing. So yeah, I've ridden there. I've ridden what other tracks? Mountaineer, I had a race up there. Mahoning Valley, I ridden a race up there. I won one up there. I think that's it. So I've ridden six or seven tracks. So that's pretty good.
And you're pretty fortunate to have been riding at places like Churchill and Keeneland early on in your career, doing so well, riding with some of the best riders in the country. Which out of those that you've mentioned, which track is your favorite so far?
It'd have to be Del Mar.
Nah,
I love Del Mar. I know. The Keeneland, definitely Keeneland. Keeneland, I'd say, is on par with Del Mar. Those two, I only really like Del Mar the most just because of the beach and everything there. I had a good time out there. But Keeneland, I'd say for the prettiest track, would have to go to Keeneland. I've ridden that, and I really enjoy riding there because it's right in Lexus, it's where I live. It's nice just to go out of my apartment, get in the car and drive 5 minutes and be at the track. And I really like Keeneland. Churchill I love because I've had the most success there as well. I've ridden 6 winners there so far, so I really like that track as well. Ellis, I liked Ellis, but it was hot and it was a 3-hour drive. Those are the two things I didn't like about Ellis. It was too hot. And Belterra I really like as well. That's a sweet little track. That's where I rode my first winner in America, was at Belterra. Yeah, I mean, Turfway as well. It's definitely, you know, not many people like Turfway, but I like Turfway. I did good there last year, and that car holds a place in my heart. You know, I rode a lot of winners there, and that's the place where people gave me real big opportunities. So I liked Turfway as well.
And we talked again during the break that you will be continuing, you will be going back to Turfway, but you're also going to be riding your off days at Tampa.
Yep, I will be. I'll be trying to ride down to Tampa when I'm needed. Michael Ann Ewan is a trainer I've ridden quite a lot for this year. And she's going to be taking her string down there. She's the horse, she trained the horse I won on Saturday. She said, you know, can you come down and ride them for me? So I said, yeah, definitely. You know, she's a very good trainer, and her horses always run really well, and they're nice horses that she's got. And it'd be exciting, you know, different, another experience to try out being down at Tampa. But like I say, I'll be mainly at Turfway throughout the winter. Wednesdays, I'm going to go down to Tampa, definitely on every Wednesday on the off days of, because that's on the off days of Turfway. And then, you know, if there's A stakes or big races that I'm needed for, I'll definitely be heading down to Tampa those days. So it'll be fun.
Lots of traveling in your future, Jack, but you'll love Tampa. I love Tampa. And unfortunately, we're out of time. This hour flew by. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much for having me on.
Been a blast here visiting with jockey Jack Gilligan. He has a very, very bright future in front of him. If you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out the podcast on our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thank you for listening.